week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast, hosted by Data Protection People. I'm the producer of the podcast, Miles Dacres, and I'm joined for the purposes of this intro by David Holmes and Phil Brining, the host of today's session on cybersecurity. How do you think that went, gents?
I think we're good. Oops, sorry, Dave.
You go first, Phil.
No, you go first. After you.
I thought it was very good. It's obviously cyber is one of those issues that's becoming, it seems to be coming more and more prevalent across organisations we work with, more and more prevalent in the news. And it's really interesting to try and dig into some of the points around the topic. And I found it quite useful, especially with some of your insight there, Phil.
Well, we talked about quite a lot of stuff, didn't we? Quite broad ranging. So I'd come back from this PCI European Community event in Milan from last week with some, you know, really fascinating stuff that I'd picked up on. So I watched a live demo of a JavaScript attack, a Magcart attack it's called, where you get in the redirection of payment pages, which was fascinating. So we talked about that in the session. And then this cable, the OMG Elite cable, which is a charging cable with a built-in web server and Wi-Fi. And again, fascinating technologies that are there tools for hackers and for exfiltration of data. So we talked about a lot of stuff, and there were some great insights from some of the participants as well about legacy SIDs. We talked about Interserve, didn't we, and the fine the ICO issued.
We did, it's definitely worth reading. You pick the measures up off the ICO's enforcement website, definitely read it, because there's bits in there that I'm sure we could all learn from, not necessarily just from a technical point, but from the governance of data protection and the governance of information security. And I think there's a lot of learning that people can take from that. We do cover off some of them, but we don't cover all of them.
No, there was that risk from working from home and things like that, and risk of legacy systems. But and then you were quite surprised that, you know, well, why would anybody have an old system, you know, with an old operating system? But then we had some participants saying, well, in our industry, you know, we're still working on equipment which cost tens of millions of pounds with an embedded XP operating system, you know, and it costs tens of millions of pounds to replace it. It's got a life cycle. It's not out of its useful life cycle yet. So, you know, realization, somebody actually said, you know, and I didn't pick up on this, that there's lots of hospitals that still use faxes. And when I did some work with an online pharmacy business a year or two ago, they said that pharmacists wanted their prescriptions delivered by fax. I was quite surprised. So we had a great session, I think, you know, lots to talk about. We had loads more we should have covered off, but we'd run out of time, didn't we?
We certainly did. We certainly did. And I think we'll review some of those bits, and I think we'll maybe throw them into next Friday's session, I think.
Yeah. So one of the things we talked about briefly was, I think people should try and pick up on this as well, a really interesting court case where a compensation was awarded, £250 compensation. But again, you read the court case, and it's really interesting to pick up on how the courts arrived at their decision, the breaches of security, unfair processing, you know, not purpose orientated. And what was interesting for me was this court case was made under the Data Protection Act 2018 because of the Law Enforcement Directive, not the GDPR. So there's some really interesting features there. So again, we've mentioned that, and I think that's well worth reading. It's quite quick to read, but it's really insightful.
No, for sure, for sure.
So what are we doing next week?
We're on the GDPR radio next week, so we've got another fun and fluid session over what's in the news. I think one of the things that we want to look to next week, we kind of ran out of time to really cover it this week, is the chief exec within Uber following the breaches or the cyber issues and the cyber attacks back from 2014-2016 has been found guilty. So we'll maybe kick that around a little bit and look at direct liability. Because we never kind of covered that off enough in this session, but it's certainly something we can look at next week.
Yeah. Okay, good. So anyway, that's enough waffling from us. So dive into the session. Give us some feedback if you feel it's appropriate and necessary. You know, the conversation does carry on, the dialogue carries on outside of these sessions. So, you know, thanks for listening, and, you know, dive into the session, and hope you find it interesting and useful. Good afternoon to everybody. Welcome to the weekly data protection podcast. What did they used to call it? Ollie, Data Protection Made Easy podcast. Dave Holmes and I, you've got today, I'm afraid. Ollie left us last week, which is very sad for us as a business. He was a fantastic employee, did a brilliant job for us whilst he was with us. But he's moved on to new pastures which is just one of those things when you employ young people, they outgrow the business, they're growing at a much quicker pace. So Dave and I, we said we'd talk about cybersecurity, didn't we, Dave? Do you want to say hello?
We did, yes. Hi, everybody. Hope you're well. I'm still here. You'll be able to still join us, still partake. I will do my best where I can, and I'm sure Phil and if Miles around that may help with that. Just keep an eye on the chat. Ollie had a knack for being able to do multiple things. It may well just be an age thing that you identified earlier, Phil, but I seem to struggle to do more than one thing at once.
Speak up, Dave. I can't hear you. My earrings going a bit. So we said we'd talk about cyber. Why did we say we'd talk about cyber? Because I'd spent all last week in Milan, didn't I, at the PCI European Community event, which was really good. And I said, I've got some great stuff that I'm going to come back with. And we all said, oh, let's talk about cybersecurity then. So that's the theme for today, isn't it? But before we kick off, is there anything else, anything you wanted to raise, Dave, that's not cybersecurity related? Have you seen in the news, maybe?
There was... one thing that I was going to raise, if I can find out where I've...
That's
where
annoying
I've...
for you, Daniel. Are you sure?
Carry on, Dave.
Okay. Sorry, I wasn't quite sure if we were just getting picked up on that one. there was something out recently. I'm just trying to think what it was that I was just trying to find. I made a note of it somewhere, but then just typically I can't just remember where my notes are. I'll come back to it if I remember. But I think there's some guidance or something out from the ICO on something or other that I was going to just refer to. So let me dig around and I'll come back. Have you found anything yourself?
Well, there's an awful lot, actually. I don't really know where to start. So I don't know if we... I don't know. There's lots of stuff in the news, I thought. All sorts of stuff about directors' liability. There's been a few interesting fines. There's been a really interesting compensation case that I wanted to pick up on. Just the way that the courts have approached the kind of dismantling of the case and then saying, yeah, you failed principle one, you failed principle two, you failed principle six. Let's consider whether this information was in public domain or not. Fascinating case to get under the skin of and have a read about it. So we'll talk about those, I think, and the action. You might have talked about this last week about Google for incognito mode. They're back under pressure for that. And then another good case, Gonzalez v. Google. This is fascinating because this is taking action against Google, particularly YouTube, not for the content they're hosting, but for the algorithms that promote the content to other users. This is all about protecting, well, this particular case about protecting minors. But what the, you know, everything I'm reading is saying that, you know, if you've got algorithms that are promoting content based on what other people, what you've been viewing, then you have to take responsibility for those algorithms. And therefore you're liable for, you know, them not protecting people properly. So I think that's quite interesting.
That prompts me on what I was, I don't know if you've seen it, but the ICOs, has warned companies to stay clear from emotional analysis using AI, which is algorithms. So thanks for the prompt. I don't know if you've come across that. It's the first time the ICO has generally come out and warned organizations from doing this kind of thing because of its pseudoscientific nature that they indicate is not to be trusted and quite rightfully may cause harm if they're making meaningful decisions based on people's emotional state.
Right. I mean, that's all fascinating stuff. I mean, we're diving around a lot here. We need to probably to talk a little bit about some of this stuff rather than just mention it in passing. But that's also, I think, linked to that. You know, you probably talked about the Clearview AI fine that the CNIL, the French regulator, have imposed. And then kind of this feeling like, well, are they ever going to see a penny of the money or a cent of the money or a euro of the money? Because, you know, Clearview are pushing back saying, you've got no jurisdiction over us. So, you know, all interest, there's a lot of interesting stuff. And I ended up this week, I don't know what you've been doing this week, Dave, but I've spent a lot of time doing a PCI review. Again, really interesting, one of the world's biggest football clubs. So really complicated processing, you know, lots of data, lots of channels, lots of overseas operations, you know, great fun to get stuck into. And, you know, with my background in professional sport, I do like working in football clubs. So that was really interesting, and I'm just writing up the report findings. But I also had to have a look at the IDTAs and the TRAs, the international transfer stuff, because I was QAing a case for the support desk yesterday. Again, that was interesting. And that's pretty much been my week, really. What have you been doing this week?
Yeah, one thing, I've done a lot of training this week and working with DPOs, but one thing that I thought was really interesting, and I think we probably mentioned it slightly with one of the catch-ups we had, I'm just interested if anybody's listening who might have done the same, but has anybody been watching the capture on the BBC all about deepfakes? It's run by Whiskers. It's very similar to the dog show that comes around once a year. But the capture, it's series two. They've got a series one and series two, but it's all about deepfake technology, and it being run and used by organisations and governments kind of around the world to basically retell a version of the truth. So they know something's happening, but we can't necessarily capture it on video. So what we'll do is we'll use deepfake technology and CCTV to re-image what should have happened in order just to prove a point that they're trying to prove. Really, really fascinating series to kind of go in. So it tips into facial recognition. It tips into, like I said, deepfake technology. It dabbled a little bit in the second series that's currently on the iPlayer in relation to things like emotional, picking on emotions, picking on what people were. Very similar to the Clearview AI and the Cambridge Analytica, with trying to take politicians into power through basically saying the right things to the right audience and not necessarily otherwise and that kind of thing. So it's really, really interesting to kind of watch. Yes, it's a bit of a drama, but it's when you sat there still with your little plate still spinning around data protection and privacy, I thought it was quite interesting to watch. So if anybody's watched it and would like to either give it a thumbs up or say they thought it was rather weak, then please say so. But I thought it was a rather interesting programme on telly.
Well, I will have a look for it. So I was going to just kind of kick off, Dave, with talking a little bit about some of the interesting stuff that I looked at last week at this PCI event. The great things about it were it's the first time there's been an actual physical get together for a couple of years. So that was very nice. That was good to have a look back in a community of vendors and merchants and service providers and QSAs and ISAs. So that was good. But the emphasis of the sessions was about this transition to version 4 of the PCI DSS, which obviously we're now working with. I've now finally finished my retraining, which is good. It took me a long time to finish it off, but I've done that. But one of the things I wanted to highlight, because it is relevant to cyber, is I attended this brilliant vendor showcase from a company called JScrambler, and it was a live demo of a Magikart type of attack, where you load up a web page and you end up loading up a malicious JavaScript, and those scripts start to affect in real time the iframe that the payment gateway is presented in, and it redirects the payment. And if it's clever, which some of these attacks are supremely clever, then nobody notices. And it really good. So that was very good. And the reason why it was being highlighted and showcased at the PCI event is because there's some new in PCI 4, there's a requirement for merchants to keep a log of the scripts that are running on their payment pages and to authenticate all the scripts before they run. So that was very good. This is JavaScript specifically. What this demo was doing was showing how they work. You load up a web page, and then one of your marketing people have put Google Tag Commander stuff on your web page, and there's all sorts of other JavaScript that gets loaded up because other people have put things on, cookies and other scripts that run, and then some of these malicious scripts just kind of find their way in, usually via a third party. So, you might have thought you'd nailed down your payment page scripts, but, as soon as you start loading up scripts from third-party sources, if they get compromised, that's how they get onto the web page, and then they can start to manipulate the code. So I'm not explaining it as well as the guy from JScrambler did, but it was fascinating to watch in real time.
How do you prevent that then? Because one of the things I want to talk about later when we get into it is a particular case and looking at some of the bits. But how do you prevent that kind of thing then, with that kind of cross script kind of activity going on?
Yeah, well, with this particular, there's quite a few products out there. I looked at three whilst I was in Milan, and this JScrambler was the best demo of it by far. But I also saw demos from other companies as well. I can't remember off the top of my head, but I can find out. But basically, you've got this, you know, you've got a tool that is, you have a list of all of approved scripts, and when the web page up in real time, it's got to check whether the scripts are authentic and unauthorized, and if they are, then it allows them to run, and if they're not, then it throws a warning or stops them, or both.
Can you protect the scripts then themselves? So if it only recognizes those scripts, how do you protect those scripts?
Well, you have an image of the script that's how it should look, and then in real time you've got to compare, you know, the script, the JavaScript, right, with the system will do that with the script that's actually prevalent on the page, which might be modified by one of the other scripts on the page, and then it starts to have an alert system. I'm not sure. I don't know. I'm not sure if it's the same as cross-site scripting. It quite possibly is, and somebody here will know more about it than I do in terms of the technicalities of it. But it's a new requirement to the PCI DSS4. So a lot of people are getting these tools out there, and it was just fascinating to watch it.
And these tools should then alert you then. It either permits them because it identifies it as something that's permitted, or it alerts you because there's been a change. Therefore, you know that there's possibly somebody trying to attack the system, or there's somebody trying to maliciously provide some different code, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Now, I'm not saying that they're absolutely foolproof. And another of the very interesting discussions, which I actually didn't attend because I was doing something else, was all about quantum computing and the impact that quantum computing is going to have on the environments that we're working in. So, you know, the ability to process, you know, more quickly, more data. And, you know, I think the essence of this was quantum computing is going to shift the goalposts in terms of what we've got to do to protect ourselves once civilians start using it, you know, effectively, I think was the gist of it. But as I said, didn't attend it.
It's the case of put your money back in the mattress, not on the... not on internet banking, that kind of thing. Quantum computing will get past all your passwords with the power and the speed that it can think.
Possibly. So another thing I saw, which is, again, like, oh, blimey, where does this stuff come from? I've put a link in the chat for it, is something called the OMG USB cable.
Oh, I've seen this, yeah. Yeah, I've seen it.
Which, again, hopefully everyone's seen it, but I hadn't seen it, actually. So this is basically a charging cable, but whoever's created, the person that's created it, has got within the actual cable, they've got a USB communication port with Wi-Fi access and a web server. So basically, when you plug the cable into your phone, for instance, then, you know, let's say that you said, oh, can I borrow your cable to charge my phone? I say, yeah, of course you can, Dave. And I give you my cable. My cable will download everything from your phone and transmit it to me or to a site I specify. Looks exactly like a normal cable, you know, but it's got these this chip embedded in the actual little plastic casing, and it's apparently amazing at exfiltration of data. So again, yeah, how do you guard against these things?
Do you think that'd work in reverse? It. So if I had a mobile phone, a big one with decent memory on it, and one of these cables, and said, like, I'm not sure if it's against company policy, Phil, but could I, when I'm at work, could I charge my mobile phone through the USB port in a laptop? Would it work in reverse where it'd read the laptop, or is it just designed to read the phone?
No, it'll read a laptop. But basically what they do is they trick, again, people on here are going to know infinitely more about it technically than me, because I'm not that technical, but it tricks your computer into thinking it's a keyboard. So I picked up an interesting device called a USB blocker whilst I was over there as well, and I tried it out. So you plug it into your USB port, and I plug my headphones into it, and it only allows the power through the USB blocker. It doesn't allow data to go through it. So if I plug my headphones in through the USB blocker, then they don't work because it's only allowing power, not data, to travel through it. So I've lost my train of thought here, Dave, but basically, when you plug this cable into your PC, your PC doesn't recognize it as a charging cable. It's recognized as a keyboard, and it has a keylogger on board as well. It apparently can save up to 650,000 keystrokes on its onboard storage and then transmit it to you later on.
So what I was thinking was just from a cybersecurity point, you often see when you, I mean, I'm not anywhere near a cyber expert, but you do come across bits when you're working in DP auditing, you're looking at what appropriate security is, that kind of thing. And you find some clients have disabled the USB ports, whereas other ones you seem to walk around and everybody seems to have a phone plugged into.
Yeah, but what that they kind say of thing. That, but what do you mean disabled? You know, what have they actually done? Glued them up or try and put some logical control over how what is allowed through them? And you know,
well, no, for sure.
Yeah,
but I was trying to get to the point. I was just trying to get to the point on that one though about when you're looking at how do you prevent these things from happening. Some organisations do permit. However, they disable the USB ports. Some don't permit you to use USB for phone charging or otherwise and that kind of stuff. And others seem rather
It's a weak policy. That's trying to influence behaviour. But I mean, we're all sat here with our headphones plugged in via the USB port. You know, I've got a screen plugged into my USB port as well. You know, via USB-C, then a conversion box, a docking station. You know, is it realistic to block all access, you know, glue the ports up? I'm not sure it is.
Could you disable them electronically? So you just tell the machine not to recognize the USB port for data transfers, but you can do it for charging?
Okay. I think you could.
Can you not do that? Is that, and like I say, if anybody's on here listening, you'll realize my very simple questions give away the fact that I've got very simple knowledge around IT. And I just wondered whether in the machine or whether your antivirus could do something, some kind of software that you can download where it kind of go, well, USB ports can't be used for data transfers. Or
well, let's say you can, Dave, do something. You know, who has implemented it and how do they check it's still in place? These cables cost $180. So they're not very expensive.
Good. Interesting, though, isn't it? Because I charge my phone in the car through a cable that plugs into the car that will then give me sat-nav in the car through my Google Maps, so it could
that's
be
what mine does as well. Yeah.
So when you start thinking about where do you plug these cables, and then you can be on the train and it's got a USB port so you can charge your phone, and you can be on an aeroplane and you can plug it into the TV set in front of you, that kind of thing. You're kind of thinking, crikey, the options of how much data you could get just through these cables.
I know there's lots of stuff going on the chat now, Dave, to advise us about what we can and can't do. But anyway, I found this OMG cable quite fascinating, really, to be honest. Kind of on a linked note, Dave, I noticed that, was it the ICO fined Interserve £4.4 million?
Yes. That's right. Quite interesting. Did you actually read the
I did. I was raising it, yeah.
I've read through that. And I was kind of thinking, well, they've made quite a few errors, to be fair. So no wonder it's 4.4 million quid. When you start to kind of go through there, it starts by informing you that they've contravened the security principle, Article 51F. So one of the sixth data protection principle. It also identifies that they've contravened, as you'd imagine, security of processing at Article 32. But then it goes into it a bit deeper, and you've got internal policies that state you shouldn't be using out of date software, and some of the software that they were using had like old servers, Microsoft servers, that had its end of life in 2015 that was still being used, that was contrary to their own internal policies on network management and that kind of thing. And I was kind of reading through it thinking, it's rather damning, this, isn't it? I don't know if you got the same impression, but I was kind of thinking, your policies are hanging yourself. Even whether you should or shouldn't be doing it, your policies state you shouldn't be doing it.
I don't know if anybody else has read this and has got any kind of, let me stick it in the chat, any kind of, just so you can speed read it like we have to do sometimes. I was really interested in how it arose, to be honest. So, you know, this arose through a phishing email attack and a home worker. And because they were working from home, the connectivity into the corporate systems went a different route, which wasn't as actively monitored. That's by kind of paraphrasing and dumbing down what actually happened. And the endpoint security did flag up there was a malicious file, but didn't do anything about it. Nobody did anything about it. And then basically, once the malicious attackers were inside of the corporate networks via this compromised laptop, then they locked up some of the databases, didn't they? Like 260 odd, 283 systems and 16 different accounts, including 12 privileged accounts. So what this was, what I found fascinating and interesting was this was a ransomware attack, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. And the ICO has ruled, quite rightly, that it's actually a breach of security. So, there was no stealing of data. Data was just inaccessible. It was locked up, wasn't it? So it was an unauthorized access of personal data. And then they've set the fine at 4.4 million. But you're right, there's lots of failings in there. But when you read it, you think, could this have been foreseen? Would it have happened if the employee had been working in the office? Is this a factor of working from home during the COVID? Lots of interesting, but again, quite interesting to read. I do like reading these things because, you get an insight into, failings of other people, and then linking it back to what we're talking about, how do you ensure that you've got all these bits and pieces you think in place?
Well, for sure, and whether taking out the technical side of things, it's that governance of information security and the governance of data protection systems. Some things in place. How do you demonstrate you're adhering to what your policies say, what your procedures should be indicating that they did the course of action? How often do you review that? Where do you look for opportunities for improvement and so on and so forth? But they've, like I said, they said that their IntraServe were processing personal data on unsupported operating systems and had indicated that they were using an MS Server 2003 that had an end of life of July 2015, but it was ended its support in 2010. And you're kind of going, surely this must be picked up. When you're looking at audits and reviewing bits and policy documents, how do you give effect to this? How can this kind of be missed? It's just, I may be looking too deeply, but you'd have thought so many failings. You're kind of going, how can it have been missed if the thing's not supported and it's past its end of life in 2015?
I don't know, but you're not wrong. It's right, you're right. But InterServe's a big organisation as well.
It just means you've got more people looking at it. might be a big organisation. You've just got more people looking at it.
You might be wrong there. Now, talking of policies and procedures, I'm going off down a tangent here. I was peer reviewing a data protection audit report that Lynn wrote for us about a client. And we were recommending, this is a fairly sizable organisation, 700 employees, 100 billion turnover. And we were recommending that they documented some of their operating procedures, like, for instance, rights handling procedure and procedure for appointing processes and breach management and doing DPAs. And they really quite aggressively pushed back on us and said, we don't think it's necessary to document these things. We've got a small team that's handling it, three of us, and we know what we're doing. And, we think it's unnecessary red tape. And we ended up saying, well, look, you're the controller, on your head be it. But, in our experience, having these things undocumented means that there's potential for variations in your process over time or between team members. And if you all got, left and got wiped out, you're not helping the organization. If you have something that you have to. Are you going to co-op people in if you haven't documented? So why would you? Why would you not document them? And it was like, it's too much effort. Well, crikey, if that's your attitude, I still find it quite strange that people take that view. It's too much effort to document a rights handling procedure, therefore we won't bother. Fundamentally, it provides a starting point for assessing and benchmarking performance, doesn't it, as well as behaviour.
But would they take that same attitude to financial regulation? Would they say, well, I'm not going to detail how we deduct tax on people in our report to the HMRC. Why do we need that? And I sometimes wonder whether it's or health and safety or whether you're caught by any other regulator and regulatory obligations and whether they take that side of things or whether really personal data is still a little bit of the poor cousin, that kind of thing, where it's, well, we're doing all this anyway and, well, we're not going to do it for this because it seems rather excessive. It seems like it's kind of it's a regulator with teeth and a regulator can take a lot of action against you, but sometimes you think the internal bite with data protection maybe not got the same focus as organisations give to any other regulatory action.
Yeah, the another aspect of this InterServe I was interested in, the decision notice, the sort of monetary penalty notice, was the fact the ICO went to great lengths explaining their RAP, their what does that stand for, the regulatory action policy, is it? And saying, we said we were going to do this and we're going to do it. You know, we're taking a risk-based approach, and we think this is a high-risk scenario, effectively what they've said into it. So again, there's a great fun to read them because there's quite a lot in there.
Well, it is, and this is where the damning bit comes, because it said that they failed to provide evidence of a pen test in 2 years prior to the incident, which was contrary to their threat and vulnerability policy. So who's managing and monitoring the threat and vulnerability policy if you've... You know what I mean? If it's contrary, then the policy must state that you've got to do vulnerability testing and pen testing.
Well, how often is the policy reviewed? It might be a 3-year cycle or something. You know, I think that's way too long for anything in this space. Everything's moving too fast. But you know, if that's what the they might well be within their framework of their expectations in terms of governance. But it makes you say, why have you got a 3-year review cycle? Or, I mean, I do this all the time. You read it when I'm doing auditing. I read a policy. Right? The other week, I read a data protection policy, which had been reviewed in April 2021 and signed off by senior management. And the policy still referred to the Data Protection Act 1998, and it had been reviewed a year previously. Well, who's reviewing it? You know, what are they looking for?
Spelling errors.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I don't know.
I've looked at that in Word, and there's nothing underlined in red, so it must be okay.
I don't know. Now, Michael raises a very interesting point, and again, you're going to know more about this than I do, but airlocking. I read something a few years ago that the effective distance between two servers for airlocking is something like 10 miles.
Okay.
Because apparently some Israeli company have got this mechanism, this system for somehow reading data off servers miles away, despite there being some form of airlock. So I don't know if anybody's got any further information on that, but I'll have to try and find it again.
Yeah. I've not heard of that as a you'd have thought.
I think we in terms of airlocking, I think what you do is you basically have, as you're right, you airlock. It doesn't necessarily have to be 10 miles, it can be 10 yards, but it, in a sense, it's ensuring, and this happens a lot within the NHS, if you have got an unsupported server, it's running a legacy system that's vital to operations. Again, this happens a lot in the NHS. You make sure that server has no outlet to the internet. You know, it's not isolated, internet-facing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's completely isolated. And then everything else that deals with it is on a very much, so an encrypted single line, just to ensure that there isn't a backdoor in. But yeah, it's interesting conceptually, because, you know, that I think with the Israeli case you were talking about, they actually managed to, somebody got in there, didn't they? And they sneaked in almost like a USB sort of Wi-Fi adapter, which they just literally plugged into the back of the server, giving them a back route into the server that wasn't internet facing. So no matter how clever we are, there's always something a little bit cleverer.
Just as clever on the other side. Yeah, exactly. Now, is that
it makes you interested, though, how many legacy systems are run like that? You know what I mean? There's certainly, I've worked with a client that had a legacy system that they'd switch on to get the information off it, then they'd switch it off because they were concerned about the risks around it. And it just makes you wonder, doesn't it?
Well, I think there'll be a lot.
Look at how many mainframes that were built in the 70s and 80s are still used in national infrastructure, you know, and these might have had security updates for 30 years. You know, they probably haven't even got the technical staff to support them anymore. You know, it's a sort of an availability issue. You know, there's got to be a way of maintaining these and keeping them off grid is perhaps the only way to maintain some of our more critical systems. It's quite scary, to be honest.
Yeah, I read, and again, you're on the inside, Michael, the NHS has got lots of legacy systems, because to replace them is going to be, you know, incredibly expensive. And actually, you know, some applications may not run on newer technologies or newer operating systems.
What'd be really interesting as well, Michael, and it's only a quick question, is I don't know if you've done it a bit kind of within the NHS or anything, been through procurement for things like that, but whether the government's so restrictive on what they want the systems to do that by the time they've actually agreed it and got this thing built, it's already out of date, or is that just me being rather cynical?
I think a bit of both. I have to be honest, a bit of both, and it's not necessarily just in the NHS. Government procurement is the same all over. I think the biggest risk to government is when organisations go into liquidation or stop providing updates for that version. And effectively, it's connecting to medical devices, etc., that are required on that version. There's lots of medical devices that maybe have onboard Windows XP, onboard Windows 2000. So, you know, it isn't just simply the computer. It may be the onboard operating system on the device itself.
You might have spent £50 million on a machine or a scanner, and it happens to be based on Windows XP. I think to Peter's point, I think we're talking about air gapping. I think we're talking about the same thing, but I read it as gapping rather than locking, actually, to be fair. So I might have misrepresented.
Actually, I should have said air gapping. Air locking is more about that different location. Air gapping is, you know, literally non-internet facing.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you talk about isolating them, you're talking both physically and logically, or just physically? So, you know, are they still connected to networks, internal networks, or are they disconnected?
They're disconnected from internal networks that are internet facing. Effectively, there's like one pipe in, and that, you know, obviously for transactional. And as you said earlier, that may actually only be once a day for that transitional data, in a sense.
Yeah. It's complicated. Well, I think it's complicated stuff. But, you know, again, I'm looking at some bits. I was doing this PCI review for this football club, and doing it remotely. It's not a proper review. It's more of a kind of a one day overview for them of where I think they need to focus. But trying to, without data flow diagrams and network diagrams, it's very hard to envisage how things are connected. Now, because, you know, I've worked in football, I get, you know, you go to the ticket office or the box office windows, and there's a ticketing system, and then on the outside of the window there's a PIN entry device, you know, credit card machine, whatever. But how they're connected together is the key, isn't it? And, you know, they couldn't tell me. So I've got loads of unknowns. And also they've got their in-house coders that are coding the payment pages, which is like dynamite, really, two of them. But they're on, because they don't process that many card transactions, they're self-assessing. But I'm absolutely convinced they're undercooking their self-assessment, because they won't know that all this coding and storing, they have a vault that the store 1500 card details of their high net worth individuals to stop pestering them to, you know, do you want to come to this European game, etc. So again, they won't know that that's all got to be held within the, you know, structure of the requirements of the PCIDSS. But you know, there's just loads. I think there's loads of people that are self-assessing that just get the scope of it completely wrong. Anyway, Connie, I'm going. So how do we go to that? We're talking InterServe, weren't we? Yeah.
So we're looking at some of the real technical bits. And when you're looking at security, you're looking at technical and organisational measures. And as you and Michael's demonstrated, my technical knowledge is maybe rather lax. But as indicated by InterServe, a lot of the organisational measures, the governance measures around data protection and information security, clearly weren't there, or clearly weren't adequate enough in order to have early identification for this and early notification that there may well be issues arising within their infrastructure that they've implemented in place. Now, it's interesting to kind of consider, because I've just looked at a couple of stats as well when I was kind of just having a bit of a nosy around, because you can look at weak infrastructure and being hacked and things. But I was reading a notifiable data breaches report, and I think it's from the Australian Information Commissioner, and it's dated February 2022. And they have 55% of all data breaches were coming from malicious and criminal attacks. So would you say, and it's probably a self-evident question, but I'll ask it now, would you say the biggest threat is still through phishing and that side of things, as opposed to from compromises to network security?
I think we should put that out to to everybody. What I was hearing at the PCI event last week is that malicious insiders are more likely to become more prevalent, you know, given the financial crisis, and, you know, apparently, you know, more people looking for different ways of making an extra buck. But phishing, I think, is still, you know, one of the biggest issues, isn't it? Third parties, though, major problem. Third parties, you know.
Because the stats, it breaks it down further. So it's of the 37% of all data breaches resulted from cybersecurity incidents, There was 32% from phishing from compromised credentials, 28 from compromised or 28% from compromised or stolen credentials, 23% at ransomware, 8% at hacking, and 5% down at brute force attack. And it's just obviously we need to kind of pull them apart and have a look at and maybe read in depth a bit more of the report to understand what means in there. But as a top line, I just wondered whether that kind of made sense in.
Well, I think Peter is spot on that, and I used to have some statistics like that. 90% of data breaches or security incidents are caused by humans, and the 10% that aren't, that are technical issues, are caused by humans. So yeah, passwords being wrong isn't the technical problem. That's ultimately a human problem, but it might fall into the technical category. You know what I mean? So not changing, you know, passwords, et cetera, is a human condition rather than a technical problem. But I think that you know, phishing is preying on this whole social engineering, and you know, I think that absolutely, you know, as soon as you introduce humans, you're introducing issues, and you've got no option but to introduce humans.
And as a consequence of humans, and then partly a consequence, do you think we over rely on security, thinking, well, the IT is there, the IT department, the technical stuff should protect it, and therefore that should be sufficient? And do you think there's an over reliance on IT?
I think so, and I think there's an over reliance on assuming the status quo remains intact. So, you know, let's say you take the human out and you've got system to system communication via an API, you know, that might be okay, but then that might develop a vulnerability. You know, how often are these things getting checked? You know, again, the people on the call probably know far more about this type of stuff than we do, Dave. But
and if that's the case, please feel free to unmute. It's as much your session as it is ours, so please do feel free to unmute and join in, and or drop you the comments in the chat, and we'll try and keep an eye on the chat. But you're more than welcome to unmute and take some air time to support the conversation.
So Michael's saying, yeah, we've got a duty to tool up the humans, you know, provided with the right tool to get the job done and protect them and the colleagues and the network and the business and the data and the data subjects. But I mean, it's a fact of life, isn't it? And it's been around for some time, and it's not going to go away.
Just come back to the point that security is not necessarily going to be absolute. And from a GDPR point, it doesn't ask for absolute security either, does it? Ask for appropriate security that's appropriate to the risks. Well, so we're not looking at absolute security by the definition under Article 32.
No, and that's one of the things I like about the GDPR, that it reflects the fact that it might vary from person to person, from system to system, from organisation to organisation, and from month to month. You know, so you know, how are we ensuring that what we've got in place is appropriate at that point in time for that type of processing activity? That requires some kind of formal risk analysis. Again, we often find that that's not there in many data controllers or processors. You know, they haven't got that formal recognition, review, documentation of risk. And without that, arguably, what's your baseline for determining what your technical and organizational measures are going to be?
For sure, because I've looked at security quite a bit, both with the LLM and also within some of the training that we're delivering around security. And you've got the DPIAs for high risk processing, but then you've under Article 32, you've got the need to implement appropriate security that's appropriate to the risk. And then further in there, you need to identify the risks under Article 32, that you need to identify the risks that your processing activities present. So the whole lot kind of indicates we should be doing risk assessments. And in order to do that and give account to kind of the accountability principle, then arguably that risk assessment needs to be documented, reviewed, maintained, and part of a common review cycle, if it's quite fundamental to the organisation, you'd have thought, because it's that risk assessment, it's that identification of risk and the management of that risk that will ensure that you're considering whether the security that you've implemented is still appropriate to that risk.
Yeah, one would have thought. I think Sean's point, again, is spot on into, you know, logging is key. Logging, you know, network events and logging activity of users and stuff like that, and then looking for exceptions and looking for things that stand out as being odd, and having a log server is good, you know, as long as it's, you know, tamper proof, etc. So, you know, you might, because on our Salesforce system, we can restrict the IP address that we can log on from, their log on hours, their territory to log on from. There's a whole range of things you can do to narrow down, you know, when people, so I could say, well, you can only log on from the office and from your home IP address. Mm-hmm. So if anybody attempts to log on from using your credentials from somewhere else, then we could have an alert. But is, you know, Sean's right, you know, who's checking the logs? What's getting logged and who's checking them?
Who's policing the police? That kind of thing. By analogy.
Who's... Well, not so much who's policing the police, but who's, you know, if you've got lots of events being logged, you know, and the IT department's job every morning is to review the logs and then go and investigate things that are odd, then that's fine. But do we work in organisations that have factored in that, well, you know, you can have a free morning in case anything arises, or is it like nose to the grindstone, get your emails done, get this done, get that done,
and you address it when something flags up, when the system
then everyone skims through stuff, don't they? Again, it could be that the fact that you check them every morning and everything's okay, so it becomes a bit like a wallpaper, it just becomes a routine, you don't notice that there's something odd.
I don't know. And is that, do you think partly that's down to training of what to look for, what's odd? Because and the only reason why I'm saying that is because when I used to fly small aircraft and things, you used to make sure that your engine temperatures and pressures and oil and stuff was in the right places. But you could tell a problem was occurring before it occurred if you noticed that the temperature was increasing, but the oil pressure was decreasing. But it could still be in the permissible element in that sense, but by watching it you could identify that something's going to occur before the needle suddenly plummeted to the red and you needed to kind of land the thing
to the ground.
You know what I mean? So I wonder whether some of it's are people, when we get these kind of systems, we get these kind of kits and this kind of monitoring, is there appropriate training on how to identify stuff before the system actually tells you? Is it configured properly? Have we got appropriate training and awareness around that? Or is it literally this bit of kit does everything, and when that bit goes red, you need to address that? So is there an over-reliance on the technology?
I think there could be, and there might be an over-reliance on technicians. And I'm going to say that I would have thought that most network systems people, IT support desk people, have had adequate training in order to identify, you know, what they should identify. That might be a generous sweeping statement. I'm interested in the discussion about multi-factor authentication and Ellery saying that it's not the golden bullet. And that makes sense. You know, I want to have a look at that YouTube video later. But I don't know if anybody's got any further thoughts on multi-factor authentication. It's been adopted as one of those things like, oh, this is an absolute saver, isn't it? But I think I can't see how it's infallible, you know, so I'll be interested to have a look into it in a short while.
There's many flavors about MFA, but yeah, it isn't infallible. I think it potentially reduces the amount. That's all we can do is reduce the number of incidents. I know that Microsoft for Office 365 have just introduced a secondary MFA where you go on to long, it provides you with the number before you then provide it back a number, which would take away the sort of iPhone screen hacks that we've been seeing with MFA, you know, where the code comes up on screen because you've got it on your lock screen and stuff. So they are making it better. But I mean, you've got biometric USB readers and all these other things that you can use as part of MFA. But it's not a silver bullet, but hopefully it's at a price point that makes it efficient inexpensive. So yeah, no.
I think your point about lock screen, again, it's not necessarily the technology that's wrong, it's the human use of the technology that might be the weak point. We mentioned MFA bombing a couple of weeks ago, Sean, I haven't done one of these sessions for many weeks, but last time we were on, I mentioned that there was again a cyber attack where let me just get this right. So when you go on to, If you've had your username and password compromised and you've got MFA on the account, then as soon as you try to log on, it'll send you an MFA and you might dismiss it. And as soon as you dismiss it, it'll send you another one and then another one and then another one. And eventually, what the study I was referring to showed is that people eventually get tired of it and accept the MFA despite knowing that it's not a valid attempt to log into a system. So again, that's humans, you know, responding to these threats. But yeah, I'm aware that MFA bombing is a thing. but I mean, we all moan about it. I moan about it. We have to do the, I'm looking for it now, the NatWest bank line system that we use for doing all our finance on. We've got a card, we've got a card reader, we've got a password, we've got an eight-digit PIN to log on to the card reader. We've got a 13-digit password to log on to Bankline. And it takes ages to log on to the system. And then it throws you out after about 120 seconds of inactivity. So you're constantly logging in. So it's a right pain. But, you know, accepted, it needs to be there.
No, for sure. You see quite a lot of that, don't you, with the authenticator apps and MFAs and all that kind of complicated password and bits and pieces. I wouldn't have thought it was 100% fit for purpose in that. Well, fit for purpose, yes, should I say, but maybe not 100% secure in that sense. And I get the argument on that one. And it's certainly interesting to follow around. I was just wanting to come back to when you mentioned about being able to set monitoring activities and IP addresses and kind of provide permission from where people are sat and things. When you're talking about this kind of thing, are you talking about just products that are naturally built into the system, or are you talking about fancy bits of kit like Zeem software and all that kind of stuff?
Well, in the case of Salesforce, it's just part of the setup, you know. So the standard setup is that you can, you know, quite well lock down account access, and then when an account has accessed the system, you know what they can see and what they can do. It's really easy to do. So, you know, if you've got, you know, we restrict access for all our users to various objects on the database where the data is held, and we restrict access to doing things like, you know, creating reports and, you know, accessing particular record types. I love it. As everyone who's been on here with me knows, I think it's a phenomenal system. It's blooming expensive, but it's a phenomenal system. As long as you know how to manipulate it, you can, you know, to a large extent, control a lot of access to data. Again, not infallible, but it's a good system. But I mean, sure, other systems have got, you know, add-ons and bolt-ons, but in the case of Salesforce and probably Microsoft, I don't know Microsoft Dynamics very well, you know, it's a standard kit, and if you don't deploy it, you'd say, well, why not?
Yeah, no, for sure. Because I know some people, some organizations, some clients I work with, they've got the Zeem technology, so the security information event management kind of technology operating in the background and things, and it all seems very good. But I've also worked with clients that have had experienced kind of either security incidents or personal data breaches from having kit that they're just not configured properly. A common kind of example of that would be files leaving an organization through an email because the DLP that they've got available to them has not been configured in order to if it was configured, shall we say, it might be easier way of saying, if it was configured, it may well have caught the email because of the content of the attachment, that kind of thing. So again, I think you're right, it's kind of still coming back to the fact that, well, security can only go so far, and is it a security issue or the human that's implementing it, configuring it, using it, deploying it, that kind of thing. It's got that still that overriding human element to that.
One of the things that came across loud and clear last week was the weakness in supply chain. Again, we've harped on about this for a long time. And this particular case, I attended and I spoke to a couple of people who specialize in securing contact centers where they're processing credit card information. With the PCI, if you've got, you know, certain things in place like the DTMF or masking of the dial tones, then, you know, the system assumes that, you know, as long as you're working with a compliant provider of contact services, then assumes that, you know, it's a compliance setup. But, you know, they were saying, you know, there's a massive amount of weaknesses, and actually the hackers are now targeting third parties and supply chains because they're easier than attacking the real target. So that was, again, interesting. We've been going on for quite some time, haven't we, about, you know, you've got to get supply chain under control. And I'm sure everybody on here knows that. You know, it's got to get due diligence on them. You've got to do monitoring of them. You know, that is a fundamental weakness, I think, in any system, which is outside of your control. You're relying to a great extent on people having the same, a decent brief, and then the same values and the same systems and the same dedication in their personnel. And some have, some haven't. And again, this came out when I was doing this PCI overview, you know, saying, well, You've got a contact center. Yeah. So you take credit card payments in contact. Yeah. You know, do you control access to it, or is it a general office? Oh, it's a general office. Are people allowed to take their phones in there? Yeah, they are. You know, do they take pen and paper in there? Yeah, they do. What happens if it gets, you know, you have a cup game and there's a rush on? Oh, you have an overflow facility with Ticketmaster. And have you been to check out Ticketmaster? Nope. You know, right. Okay. Well, that's another vulnerability, you know, potentially in there. The Ticketmaster might have a more professional setup than the club, but, you know, ultimately, you know, until you've been to have a look at it, you don't know.
For sure. And that obligation is still there in under security processing, isn't it? And it's that obligation under the GDPR to make sure that you only appoint processors that can meet the regulation. It's kind of worded in that sense within the GDPR. So it's really interesting that that's still a weak point, although we do see the supply chain pushing. We do see organizations within the supply chain coming to us and kind of going, we're losing business because we can't demonstrate this. Can you work with us on our compliance? So
we're seeing
more and more, which is good. The opposite to that, but I just wondered, I've got my own views on it, but I'll just ask a question again if anybody's listening in that might have an answer to it, or whether you've seen it yourself, Phil, is actually whether from a cybersecurity point, the level of security is being driven by the cyber insurance company saying, well, we're not going to insure you unless you've got X in place, or unless you can demonstrate you've got Y in place in that sense. Do you see the insurance companies driving a lot of the compliance around the levels of a security that's implemented nowadays?
I don't think I've got enough experience to comment on that. My only experience really is in our business, that the insurance companies haven't put any pressure on us getting cyber insurance. we've done it, but more to comply with tender obligations in the supply chain. But, you know, I don't think, if, for them, it's probably another product to sell, but there's certainly no pressure. I think if Lisa's answering the same question,
it's not necessarily trying to sell you anything. It's more saying, well, unless you can demonstrate you've got appropriate security, we're not going to give you cyber security because you're not deemed to have appropriate measures in place, that kind of thing. I've heard of it once with one client saying that they needed to demonstrate, they needed to switch something on in order to obtain a kind of a lower premiums for cyber insurance.
I think that'll come, but I don't think it's there now. So when we took our cyber insurance out, they didn't ask for anything. It was like, you know, what, apart from the volumes of data and the nature of the data. So they have some kind of notion about that, but not the controls we've got in place. No questions at all about that. So
this is an interesting concept, isn't it? If you take that kind of concept where compliance is being driven by the supply chain, or compliance, or maybe not compliance, but level of security is driven by the supply chain, as you've indicated, as we've seen, but also from insurance companies, that security is getting better because different players in the market are kind of the driving forces behind it, not necessarily just to meet regulatory requirements.
Yeah, I think I want to dive off a slight tangent. I think what Sean said at 1319, again, spot on, you know, bringing it all back. No matter what you put in place, ultimately, privacy by design or by default, minimize data, you know, minimize access to data, you know, put anonymize or pseudonymize data at the earliest opportunity. That's what the GDPR principles are all about. You know, so, you know, you can put with security what you want around, but ultimately, if you've got less data in an identifiable format, then it's less of a risk, isn't it? I think that's what Sean's saying. But if he's not, then I that's my take on what you on what you've said. Sorry, I'm scanning through the chat here. No pressure from insurance company. Generally, the forms are poor. Breach insurance paid out. I've not heard of that actually. Not heard about that. I don't know if there's lots of caveats about that, but
I've not heard that. Ellery is interesting because she's had an insurer reject controls they accepted last January this year, but they accepted the controls in the end and reduced the cover significantly. So maybe it is coming. Maybe it is. Like I said, I had heard of it once or twice, but maybe it is. And it would kind of make sense because the insurance companies would want to reduce their liability to pay out, surely.
Assuming they are paying out, maybe what Alan's point is that, you know, you can pay for the insurance and never get paid out. But I'm going to put this in the chat because this particular court case that I think is worth a read. This is a summary of it from Panopticon, but I mean it's got a link through to the actual case itself, and I'm changing little subject here. Quite happy to keep talking about cyber. Oh, well, let's keep talking about cyber. But that court case is really interesting. I'll tell you what, a couple of things in a snapshot. Why? One, the first thing I noticed is it's now the King's bench, right? Not the Queen's bench division of the court. So that was the first thing I noticed. Like, oh, wow, I haven't seen that before. Then I noticed that the action was taken under the Data Protection Act, because this was actually law enforcement directive related stuff, not GDPR. So again, that was like, oh, I've not seen that before either. So it was really interesting. And then there was the breach, the sending of an email containing the personal data was determined by the court to be a personal data breach. So again, that was interesting, because I've not seen that before in writing from the courts. And then the breaches of principles 1 and 2. I've not seen a breach of principle 2 expanded upon by the courts before. You know, this purpose orientation specified explicitly. So that again was quite interesting. And then there's a bit of an argument and discussion about, well, this information was in the public domain anyway. And then there's a discussion about, well, what is the public domain, and was it or wasn't it in the public domain? And then one of my favorite subjects of all time, Dave, is that the individual who made the complaint wasn't mentioned in any way, shape or form in the email that was the thing that the court case was all about. But the courts determined that it still contained his personal data, because he was identifiable from it. So again, that again is fascinating, because how many times have we come across people saying, well, you know, it's not name and address, not email address, not a phone number, in personal data. So I'm going to use this as one of the kind of example cases in the training. I have read through this and pull out all these really fascinating points in there. Anyway, there's a link to the Panopticon review of it. And in there is a link through to the actual court ruling, which isn't that long.
So they awarded £250, wasn't it? So was that against the individual you just mentioned that was identifiable but wasn't mentioned within an email?
Correct. Yeah. So the complainant brought the claim, but the court basically said, yeah, the Crown Prosecution Service, I think it was against, was in the wrong for all these different reasons. But we think there was such a negligible impact that we're only going to award £250 damages.
So did it indicate what harm the individual felt he had from that?
But yeah, he did say in there, I can't remember exactly what he said had happened, but they said it was this was at the lowest end of the spectrum, and therefore awarding damages of £250.
Wow. Okay.
He said he was suffering from anxiety and depression and other things as well. So. And there was no medical evidence, I think, from memory. I mean, again, I've just skimmed through this, but very good. Right, back to what's going on in the chat then. Insurers bundled dark web monitoring. Right, okay, interesting. Political embarrassment. What's that one referring to?
Was it this case? The Panopticon case was a political embarrassment in there, possibly.
I don't know. Anyway, that was one that was interesting. Right.
Lunchtime reading. I'll go and have a look.
Lunchtime evening reading. Yes. Well, I'm afraid we've probably run out of time, Dave. It's now 29 minutes past one.
But for the very last minute before we wrap up, then, have you seen reports in the press that the government may be considering amendments to the retained EU law bill and may push back the sunset clause?
I have, yes.
And do you think, in your infinite wisdom, that will include the debt protection reform bill, or do you think that will still go through under the new political management, shall we say?
I've got no idea. I've lost track of where we're up to politically in this country. But I did see that that was actually on the cards. Yes, I did see that. But I'd have to have a think about it and have a read of it. I think there's definitely a will amongst all or some of the Conservative Party to dismantle bits of, let's say, or lessen bits of the GDPR, UK GDPR, isn't there, and the Data Protection Act. Oh, hang on, we've got some good comment in here. So, separate to the sunset clause regulation, apparently.
Okay.
Going down. I'll have to read up on that. And one of the things I was looking at, again, we haven't had time to talk about it, was this I lost my head here. what do you call it, adequacy in the US.
EU-US.
And UK-US. So that's all kind of forwarded and relevant as well. But we haven't got time really to talk about that today, so maybe we have to do some reading and come back to that next week.
We'll add it to next Friday's. We'll cover off the ins and outs and what we can make of it. I am led to believe it'll take a little bit of while to get sorted out with the EU-US. So if anybody's hoping it's going to help them out with data transfers in the short term, you're going to have at least, I think they were saying, waiting 6 to 12 months, possibly. That's what I've read anyway. So it's not going to happen overnight.
Right. What are you doing next week? Anything exciting?
I'm on the road next week in Pudmont to Leeds, aren't I? I'm going to visit, I was going to say DPP HQ, but we'll be sat around Cathy's house, so it'll be DPP HQ plus one. So I'll be up in the office for a little bit next week, some training, and I'm doing some, considering we've mentioned today about proactive monitoring, looking for areas for opportunities to improve and making sure that what we say we're doing, I've got some DPO monitoring activities coming up next week as well.
Right, interesting stuff. I'm with you Monday, Tuesday, doing some stuff. I've got a webinar to attend. But I told you this, I volunteered to write a chapter in a cybersecurity book, which is a bit, given that I've admitted to not knowing much about it. That's a bit ironic, isn't it? But I need to start that because it's all due by Christmas. So I need to carve out some diary time to write some stuff for this chapter. It's about my angle is data protection on regulation on cybersecurity. So I can write about that.
So look out for Phil's face in the local bookstore near yourself.
I'm not sure about that. Anyway, so for Thursday, I've got some time just to at least start thinking about it. That's my plan anyway. But it keeps getting pushed back in my diary as other things crop up.
Very good.
Anyway, on that note, I think we've probably run out of time. So thank you all very much indeed for joining us today. Thanks for your contributions. It's great to get a session where people are throwing in their knowledge, their opinions, their takes on things. It just adds to the session. There's no point listening to Dave and I rabbit on all the time about the same old stuff. So thank you, Dave, for your time in preparing and being on here today. Thanks, everybody else. For being with us. Thank you, Miles, as well, for organising and manning the door and everything. We're back next week, I think, with another broad chat, are we, next week?
Back with GDPR Radio next week, yeah. And then the following week, we've got managing information requests. So that'll be a popular one.
Yeah, but that's much broader than that, isn't it? I read the scope on that. That sounds like it's going to be a really good session.
It does, it does. And I think
an external speaker, haven't we?
It's Mike Wormsley, I think it is, that's coming on and joining us. So that'll be a really, really good session. So yeah, make sure you tune into that one.
Yeah, I think I'm looking forward to that. He's got some really good ideas and he's got a great background. So, and he's apparently award-winning data protection practitioner as well. So can't wait to have him on and have a chat with him and find out all about his understanding of stuff.
Yeah, great stuff. Very good.
Good stuff. I'll tune in and listen to myself next week.
Good stuff. No, it's week after. Right. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thank you very much again. And we'll hopefully catch up with you, if not before, next Friday.
All the best. Take care.